You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Jemima Houston tuku ingoa, no mai, haere mai, ki te wire, mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Tuesday the 8th of September. My name is Jemima and I'm your host and Hannah is my producer and she is in studio with me. How are you?
Good.
Yeah, we've done some more housing bits and pieces today for you for election coverage. Got right back on that, done more, which is good, always exciting. Good to look at issues that we've already looked at, but again, there's always more. E whai ake nei, coming up on the show today for our election coverage today, we are looking at housing, as I just said. I spoke to Māori Party co-leader John Tamahere about the party's housing policies and housing issues in Aotearoa. Also on the topic of housing, the New Zealand Property Investors Federation were quoted in a New Zealand Herald article this week stating that not every tenant needs or wants a heat pump. We spoke to Manawatū Tenants Union, Renters United and the Asthma and Respiratory Foundation about whether renters do need heat pumps. Hannah chats to Auckland Action Against Poverty about ending the winter energy payment, and I wrap it up with an interview with Local Government New Zealand about their call to extend the local and central government terms from 3 to 4 years. He aho whakaaro, we would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so tuku pātui mai, you can send us a text on 5395, or Waiamai Rane, you can give us a call in studio on 309 879. Also, after the show, koe e wareware e ahi ana koutou te whakarongo ki ēnei kōrero anō he pakihiri rokiroki mā runga I te pai tukutuku o Erirangi Pōho me haere ki 95BFM Irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. You can also check us out on our social medias, which is 95BFM News on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. Give us a follow and see what we're up to, particularly this election period. There's going to be some really cool stuff that's done on the wires over the next few weeks. Yeah, so anything else to add for today, Hannah, before you go off and finish some bits and pieces?
Finish bits for the wire?
Yeah, well, I will let you go and we will crack on into
it. Up the engagement.
Yeah, talk to us. We want to hear what you've got to say. Right, let's get into it.
Erirangi Pōho, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
So with the election having been postponed due to the second COVID-19 lockdown, we also paused our election coverage for a few weeks. But we're back and we have started again with housing. This week, all of the wires will be looking again into housing issues that are relevant this election. The schedule for election coverage is that we will be looking at different focus policy areas for the next 6 weeks, starting with housing this week, then local economy, then the health and the referendums, environment, foreign affairs, and then finally human issues the week just before the election on the 17th of October. We will be podcasting all of our election coverage, so you can check that out, as I said earlier, at 95bfm.com, and we will be posting things on social media just to keep you up to date and informed with all election issues. But let's begin with our election coverage today.
95BFM News Election Coverage 2020, Housing.
So this week I have spoken with Māori Party co-leader John Tamahere about his party's views on each of the policy areas we are looking at over the next few weeks. This week we discussed housing issues, we discussed the iwi build policy the Māori Party has planned, and we also talked a little bit more about other housing issues that were brought up in this government. So here is John beginning to explain what the Māori Party's housing policies are.
Okay, on housing, it fits with under the two pillars of all our policies. Oranga tangata, which is the well-being of people, and then oranga whenua, which is the well-being of our lands, waters, seas. So under oranga tangata sits our whānau first, whānau build. Now, whānau first is a affirmative action procurement program. Afro-Americans have them, our Aboriginal brothers in Australia have these programs where anything the state puts out, there is a percentage that is passed for first rights to Indigenous people or to the people that have been targeted, Hispanic or otherwise. We don't have that in New Zealand, and so we've already released that. So any building program that comes into play under the state, we would be looking to look at a take-up of Māori trade trainees, Māori labourers, Māori builders, Māori plumbers, you name it, at 25% of the post-COVID recovery deal. So we've already announced that. Because at the moment, a third of our people are on welfare and a third of our people are working poor, first fired, last hired. And so we have to change the structural embedding of our people in the lower class of our economy and society. And so our build program, Iwi Build, is about 2,000 houses over the next 2 years out of the COVID recovery deal on ancestral Māori land. So the ability for us to have land to put our houses on and repopulate some of our regional areas and to take advantage of our land base is there. Yeah, and the second one is social housing, where the 25% procurement plays in, because 50% of the waiting list to get into a house is Māori. And then there's three other parts of the policy. It can't work unless we get our supply side of housing in place. What that means is we've got about 190,000 vacant ghost houses. In Auckland, 38,000. Māori Party want to tax those empty houses, as they do in Canada, at 2% of capital value, if they're sitting idle. And they're sitting idle because they double in price every 8 years. That's the nonsense of the way our tax system rewards investment in non-productive assets. So we have to bring them into play, particularly for rentals, student rental, our people's rentals. And if you don't have enough supply, the price, therefore, drives up rentals artificially. And so you have to bring in a carrot and a stick regime to put all those houses back on the market. And that's about it.
Fantastic. Now, I just wanted to go back to that 25% number. So the 25% is the idea that it would be 25% of the government housing budget. Is that correct? Would go towards Iwi Build, so go towards building houses for Māori and also incorporating the work of Māori, you know, services and builders and, as you said, plumbers and et cetera.
Well, the legality, so the legislation is in place for this to occur. So is the money. It's already been voted by Parliament into the COVID recovery fund. So it's not a legislative issue or a money issue. It's a goodwill issue on the part of Pākehā people in this country to ensure that Māori no longer remain embedded in the wrong part of town as they were pre-COVID.
I just wanted to say some people might argue that perhaps 25% is an overshot considering Māori make up 16.5% of the population. Is there a reason that this percentage does not directly reflect the Māori population?
Yeah, because you can't have a per capita population when the wealth of this nation was built off stolen Māori assets. That's point one. And that's why we're embedded like all Indigenous people at the bottom end of our own lands. What that raises is the question of equity. So when people try to treat us equally, we always get put to the back of the queue because there's not enough of us. There's more white folk, therefore the majority rules. In a democracy, minority rights, but particularly Indigenous Māori rights, work here because people settled here by consent, not by conquest, through the Treaty of Waitangi. And we're still waiting on equality of citizenship. And so 25% adds a equity loading. Such is the difficulty in the plight of our people.
I know you spoke about public housing and that being sort of the secondary aspect of the housing policy. What are your thoughts on the current government's approach to housing with Kiwi Build?
Well, they'll hit 100,000 houses that they promised in 2017 in 472 years at present rates. 472 years. What that means is that we have to accelerate the supply side of housing. To do that, you look at the ghost houses that I've just indicated, there's 38,000 of them just in Auckland alone, and bring them into the market. What you then have to do also is be very careful about your immigration side, which cooks up the supply side because it cooks up the demand. And so while we have a colorblind immigration policy that until the supply side of the housing market meets equilibrium and demand, you're going to get low-income people's never ever having any ability or aspiration to own a house. And so you have to look at a number of settings. Tax, so you have to tax those that sit on ghost houses just making money off sitting on them because they're a bolt hole. Two, you have to look at foreign and immigrant investment in New Zealand driving the price up. That's got to be curbed. And three, you've got to put on steroids the supply side of our housing.
You just said that the supply building houses is not necessarily, as we've seen potentially with Kiwi Build, it's not the fastest thing. This government's shown that it hasn't been a quick fix. I know that there are 18,000 people on the waiting list compared to 6,000 when the coalition came into power in 2017 for social housing. And the Green Party has a policy that they've promised that 18,000 houses will be built for those people on the waiting list. What are your thoughts on how likely that is to build new houses at such a, you know, in a quick start, get them up to get people in homes?
Oh, they can be done because we built 100,000 houses in 10 years post-Second World War. You know, and that's without power tools. And how we did it was we did it under a state housing program where the state actually drove hell for leather all housing. Everyone in my street knew the way their house was configured because the way we were able to put multiples out was that you all got housing. If you look at Singapore as a model, you know, every Singaporean has an apartment to own with their family and for their family. That aspiration used to be here in New Zealand, and it was taken away in the 80s. In fact, Māori rentals requirements have gone up 88% since 1986. Māori home ownership has gone back at a great speed of knots since 1986. So the market-led model is broken. And to pretend that the market by itself is going to fix this is not true. The state has to put building on steroids, and we're very supportive of that.
And do you think that's perhaps something that, I know, with obviously COVID-19, huge economic fallout, that this is sort of the movement time. This is an opportunity for us to really change up the way that we've been doing it over the last...
Look, it's an intergenerational opportunity. You never see them come along. We had incrementalism under Clark and under Key. We lost a generation. You then need to look at, how do we change this up? Well, it's because it's a needs-based, not wants-based, it's a needs-based requirement that we do this. And we support the Greens program for 18,000 social houses put on steroids straight away.
Damn, that's a hot policy. 95 BFM.
That was John Tamahere from the Māori Party speaking on the party's housing policies. We will be right back with some more election coverage after a little break.
Convictions are a three-way stretch inside. The air in here is pretty thin, I think I'll go outside. Committed for insanity and crimes against the soul. The worst crime that I ever did was play some rock and roll. But the man is not good, just get his grip on yourself. But the man is not good, just get his grip on yourself. And you should know.
A lot of so-called kombucha is made from concentrate. That means it's tap water, flavour and non-nutritive sweetener, mixed up with some sour kombucha vinegar base. Doesn't exactly scream ancient health tonic, does it? Good Buzz is different. They're one of the only brands on the market to make authentically true brew kombucha that's never diluted. Just fermented, then bottled, so it's good, naturally. Reach for the real deal. Reach for a Good Buzz. Real good booch, brewed and bottled in Tauranga.
Were you at the gig on Friday?
What gig?
The Radical Maris Noise Collective. I never thought seven dudes playing saxophones would change my mind about capitalism, but hello.
That sounds
then
pretty...
2 hours of Nightcore remixes of Every Time We Touch.
What even?
And a white guy did a rap about feelings. So beautiful.
What? What?
Stay in the loop with the 95BFM Entertainment Guide. Online and on air 7 days a week, three times a day. 10:20 a.m., 3 p.m. and 6:20 p.m. It's gigs in that.
This is The Colour of Your Skin by Sandy Mill. You are on The Wire with Jemima on 95BFM.
Storm was blinded by the 'cause of the color of his skin. Take his life, his dignity, family, his everything, 'cause of the color of his skin. So tell me, how can this keep happening? Been going on for centuries. Cursed for the color of your skin.
Up to 8,000 or 10,000.
Shit.
The Wire.
You're tuned into The Wire with Jemima on 95 BFM. We will be back with some more election coverage later in the hour, but for now, I spoke with Local Government New Zealand earlier this morning. The group is calling for the terms of local and central government to be extended from 3 years to four. Councils around the country have shown their support for the proposal due to how it might help councils make a more long-term changes while in office, encourage voter turnout, and help make changes both in local and central government. I spoke to newly elected President of Local Government New Zealand, Stuart Crosby, about this issue. I began by asking why the government terms should be extended.
Well, over a long period of time, the business of councils has got quite complex in terms of all the processes you have to go through. So in short, a three-year term is quite restrictive in getting some real momentum going, particularly on those long-term issues, for example, urban growth development, major pieces of infrastructure to support existing communities or new communities. So your listeners may not realise it, but you know, prior to an election, councils aren't allowed to make major decisions. So there's about a three-month hiatus prior to an election. Post an election, you have to set up the council's committee structures, etc. So you're losing about another 3 or 4 months getting into the business of council. And then as you lead up to another election, the cycle starts again. So in effect, you only have 12 to 15, at best 18 months of really getting stuck into your work. And this kind of stop-start issue is creating a lot of problems because new councillors or a new mayor may come along, and rightly so, might want to review a particular project or a particular piece of work because they stood on that through the election campaign. And again, that creates delay. So what we're suggesting is that a four-year term would give a good 24-plus months to get stuck into the work.
Are there... Obviously, that's a big issue, making sure that councils can do the work that the public are hoping they will do. Are there any other issues that arise with having a shorter election term?
There's been some secondary comment around the issue of a lack of people being interested, frankly, in elections, and that's true. The turnout rate has been declining over a number of years, and we think there are a whole range of different reasons for that. One, the complexity of an election. Often there's three elections at once. There's two different voting systems. The voters don't know who to vote for because there's a lack of information. Should electronic voting take place? Well, there's security issues around those as well. So there's a whole range, to my mind, of issues that are tied up to a four-year term. The other part of our remit, which is very important, was we were calling for a referendum on this. So it being a major constitutional issue, politicians should not be making this decision. The community should be making this decision.
That's sort of what I wanted to speak about next. What does the process for getting this sort of proposal across the line look like? Obviously, you've said a referendum is something that's really important to have the community state their opinion on, but how do you go from here talking about wanting to extend the government's terms to 4 years to actually having that happen in real life?
So the initiative came from our annual general meeting of Local Government New Zealand, where councils can put up remits to go into the work plan for Local Government New Zealand. So that will happen. So the next step will be a draft paper will be put to the National Council of Local Government New Zealand and then circulated across all 78 authorities for their consideration, because it was their 87% majority support to proceed with this. And there'll be some legal advice will come with it. Then at some point in time, and I would suggest probably later this year or early into the new year with the new government being established, that I, for one, will approach the Prime Minister and or the relevant ministers to start the conversation with them, because our remit also said that central government elections should be held every 4 years, as well as local government elections.
And is that for ease, for people to know that it's always 4 years for both, or what would it...
Yes, well, part of our research will also seek advice from academics in this area, and already many of them are coming out and saying, yes, a three-year term is not the best for effectiveness and efficiency in the operation of both governments. And around the world, short-term research has indicated that New Zealand is one of the few, if not the only, with a modern democracy, with a two-tier democracy, that's local and central government, that have a three-year term. Most have moved on to a four, some a five, in some cases eight with a 50% rollover. So it's effectively a four-year one for those elected members. So there's a lot of work to be done in terms of research. But at the moment, yes, there's a year separation between the local government election. We had ours last year, and central government are having theirs this year. So you'd want to try and keep that separation in sync. And the way to do that is to have both four-year terms.
And just finally, I'd like to ask, what support has there been for this proposal? I know that there's support within a number of councils across the country, but is there public support for this too?
We haven't tested that yet, Jemima, at this point in time. So it only happened in terms of the remit on the 21st of August of this year. So part of our process will be, once we've done some more research and put that out to our 78 councils, they may wish also to consider engaging with their communities to say what do they think. So there's a lot of work to be done, but it hasn't really been tested in the community at this point in time. And one of the key things you always do before you put a proposal out is to look at all the pros and cons and put a good fact sheet out so people can engage on the basis of fact.
Their relationships with their girlfriends or their wife. No one, they shouldn't have more than one wife at a time.
The government is planning to cut the winter energy payments, cutting up to $63 a week for many low-income households, in less than a month. The Auckland Action Against Poverty is calling for these winter energy payments to continue and actually increase. I spoke to AAAP about the issue, and I started by asking them what difference an extra $63 a week would make. What difference would $63 a week make for people?
Oh, a massive difference, especially to our elderly people and to solo parents. Our elderly people can't handle that much taken off them. They're already, you know, the percentage of food grants that they're going for lately, it's just blown out of proportion. If they take the energy payment off them, it'll be worse and it'll be more stress for them. So, yeah, no, it's, it means a lot to people.
You mentioned that this is happening within a context of increasing demand for hardship grants. Is this because of increased cost of living or stagnating wages or something else?
couple of things. Number one, the increased cost of living is a big one. Rental agreements is also a big one for houses. People can't afford it because they don't get that much. People don't get much left after paying their rent, so they can't afford food. So they apply for food on a weekly basis, but they get declined a lot of the time. And medical problems too. To see a doctor after hours, especially with the elderly people, it's $72, between $72 and $75. Nobody's got that kind of money. So they go straight to the hospital because it's free.
Why does this cut make senior citizens particularly vulnerable?
For starters, their rate doesn't go up. None of us are on a living wage. We don't get enough after the rent and all our bills are paid. Especially power during the winter, that's gone up massive. Once they've paid all that, you'd be lucky if they're left with $30 a week. And our elderly folk are so proud, they're too scared to ask for food grants. And the ones that are asking for food grants, it's because they have to. They can't even afford 50 cents worth of fish.
And AAAP have said that the number of elderly asking for food grants has increased by 50%. Is that correct?
Absolutely, yes. It needs to go up to meet the living wage. And that's not only with the elderly, but that's also for, it's the cause of poverty with the children.
I guess basically, like, this cut exacerbates the income inequality that we already see in New Zealand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
With the bill for COVID-19 mounting, this cut may have been made to ameliorate costs for the government. But does cutting the winter energy payment actually make communities more vulnerable to another outbreak?
Oh, absolutely. They make it more so because of the COVID-19. The energy payment, some of the houses that are that Housing New Zealand has put into the houses don't even work properly. So people are freezing. The COVID-19 doesn't help. It's already making life impacted by our inequality and housing crisis. Ending the winter energy payment, it'll just make matters worse.
And COVID-19 is a respiratory disease, and there's a clear link between damp, cold homes and respiratory diseases.
That increases the medical, you know, that people are going through at the moment, and they can't afford the doctor, so they don't go to the doctor.
Or they go to the hospital and crowd it out and make it harder for our healthcare system to actually handle the crisis.
Oh, that's right. I myself go straight to the hospital now. I don't bother going to the MP because I have to pay all the time. And even if I got an automatic payment going to the doctors at the moment, the after-hours doctors, it doesn't apply to that.
The government only implemented two of the Welfare Expert Advisory Group's 42 recommendations for welfare reform last year. How likely do you think they are to respond to pressure from organisations like AAAP around the winter energy payment?
Oh, well, we're going to go out in a big way with this because we don't think it's not only fair, but it's not right. This is people's rights. They're taking away people's rights. They're entitled to heating. They're entitled to dry homes. They're not entitled, to let the government put them in poverty. That's just not on. So AAAP will support not to take the energy payment for any reason.
You mentioned that people are entitled to warm, dry homes. What do you think of Andrew King from the New Zealand Property Investors Federation's recent comments that some tenants would rather not have a heat pump so that they could save on rent?
Yeah, well, they can't afford the heat pump. We need at least 53 isn't enough, and that's how much they're going to take back off us. We are particularly concerned for our senior citizens renting in without savings who rely on income support to pay it. So, it's going to affect child poverty. I know child poverty action groups will call for the increase instead of cutting them. So that's what we call for as well.
Did you have any final comments that you wanted to add?
Just tell the government not to drop it. Increase it maybe, but don't drop it. It's going to cause a lot of hardship.
The Wire.
I don't know. And frankly, the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
That was Triple AP speaking on cutting the winter energy payment. We'll be right back with some more election coverage after a song. So here it is.
Five BFM News Election Coverage 2020. Decision 2020.
We are back with some election coverage on housing. Today, Hannah and I, on the mic, we were looking into, we saw an article this morning, or Hannah came in this morning with this interesting statement, and we looked into it, and it was from the New Zealand Property Investors Federation, who made a comment about, do you remember? They made a comment saying...
They advised landlords to delay installing heating in homes just in case the election result means that they don't need to.
Yes.
And basically justified it by saying, you know, some tenants might not even want to have a heat pump. So,
yes.
Yeah.
And this was in a conversation with the New Zealand Herald. And then that was yesterday. And then another article was released this morning clarifying that. What they meant was instead that, you know, heat pumps, they encourage landlords to put heat pumps in homes, but not every house needs a heat pump and not every tenant wants a heat pump. So that sort of brought us to the idea of, do we need heat pumps? Is that something we actually need within our houses and in our rental properties here in New Zealand? So we spoke to a few different people. Hannah spoke to...
I spoke to Renters United and the Manawatu Tenants Union about it, and
and I spoke to the Asthma and Respiratory Foundation about it as well, for sort of a more health perspective on whether we do need heat pumps. So I will begin with the Asthma and Respiratory Foundation, here it is. What are the health benefits of having a heat pump or a heating source in a home?
Yeah, undoubtedly having a warm, healthy home is going to improve anybody living in that home's health, basically. We know that homes which aren't well insulated or warm correlate with significant, you know, have a significant impact on respiratory health.
Do you think currently that landlords perhaps prioritise cost over the health and well-being of their tenants?
I think it's difficult. I mean, we absolutely know that you need to have a warm, well-ventilated, mould-free home to prevent respiratory diseases for people living in those unhealthy environments. But I think that the challenge is with landlords is the cost and the healthy home standards, putting those in, how those costs are going to be, you know, recouped, because we certainly don't want people to have, you know, huge rent increases, etc., that is going to impact on them anyway.
So I imagine that you know about the New Zealand Property Investors Federation made a comment saying that not every tenant wants a heat pump. Do you think it's about a want or a need issue when it comes to health?
It's probably a little bit of it's probably also a bit of education as well around the significance of having a healthy, warm home. We know that, for instance, the World Health Organization recommends indoor temperature being around 18 degrees, and if you've got babies or elderly people living in the home, then it should be around 20 degrees or higher. And I'm sure, you know, a lot of people living in cold homes don't realise that this is actually, you know, unhealthy not to be at those temperatures. So I think the challenge is that with a heat pump, you know, it is quite expensive to run, and you've already got people who are challenged with paying rent. You know, how is that extra cost going to impact on them as well?
And just finally, do you think we need heat pumps in homes?
I think that we heat pumps are probably the most effective way to heat a home in a healthy way. And I think that it is important to have heat pumps in the home to keep them dry, to keep them warm, to keep that indoor temperature at that level, and ultimately help keep people healthy and hopefully keep, you know, respiratory diseases like pneumonia and bronchiolitis, things like that, at bay.
That was Letitia Harding, who is the Chief Executive of the Asthma and Respiratory Foundation, speaking on whether we do need heat pumps in houses. We did have a little bit of a technical issue with this piece. So unfortunately we don't have the renters union aspect of the story, but it will be podcasted. But we do have the Manawatū Tenants Union, which Hannah is going to run you through now.
Yeah, cool. So I spoke to Ben Schmidt, who is a coordinator at the Manawatū Tenants Union. And I started by asking him what benefits a heat pump provides.
Heat pumps provide many benefits for tenants. Basically, they help heat a home, heat the living area, which is an essential part of living in a warm, dry, healthy home. Some circumstances, they can also be a more cheap or energy efficient option than other heating sources as well.
And what does an increase in rent mean if tenants are already paying for power? What is an increase meant to cover here?
So I think what's happening there is landlords are trying to say that the cost of purchasing and installing a heat pump is so much that it would require them to pass the cost on to the tenant and increase the rent. Look, that is an absolutely appalling attitude, and it's quite often wrong. We know it's the basic, or likely soon going to be a part of the basic legal requirements for being a landlord. And it's also a part of just a basic moral obligation to provide a warm, dry home. A lot of landlords are already doing well. They're already getting capital gains on the property, and there is no reason that a marginal improvement like providing a decent heater for a living area should have to result in a rent increase for the tenant, especially when tenants are already doing it tough, and a lot of tenants are already struggling to put food on the table after they pay the rent.
Also, isn't the whole, like, ostensibly the justification for the landlord-tenant relationship, that the landlord takes on the risk of investment in upgrading the home?
Oh, absolutely should be. It's a business, it's a commercial decision and investment at the end of the day. Sometimes landlords think that they're doing tenants a favour. That's not the case. It's a business, they're there to make money, and they should be taking those risks and those investments required into account.
And what do you make of warm, dry homes being construed as a luxury?
It's wrong, it's disgusting, and that is a large part of the reason why we have approximately 1,600 people dying every year associated with cold or housing-related illnesses. It should be a fundamental basic human right to live in a warm, dry home. It's certainly the expectation overseas, but it's not the case in New Zealand because too many people continue to think that it's acceptable for tenants to suffer for the privilege of having a roof over their head.
Do you think that tenants will opt out of using their heat pumps in order to save on their power bills? To what extent is the problem actually the quality of the housing stock itself?
I think often that question can be missing the point, because if a tenant chooses to use or not use a heat pump or a heater, that's up to them, certainly benefits to that. But the fact is they should have that choice in the first place, regardless of whether they can afford or they decide to use those heating options. A landlord should still provide the means for a tenant to be able to heat their home and for them to have that choice without having to purchase heaters for themselves and spend more expenses in the first place. So some tenants will be in a position where they may not be able to properly heat their homes, but really that's a reason for why we need to keep rents fair and affordable. It's a reason why we need to increase benefits, and also what has been missing from the conversation at times is recognising that upfront cheaper sources of heating for tenants, like some of your oil fin heaters or opening the oven, are often inefficient and more expensive in the long run. So by providing something like a heat pump or a more suitable fixed form of heating, it would be cheaper for tenants in many cases to heat their living area than it would be if they're trying to cobble together heating sources themselves.
Do regional differences affect the issue? You know, for example,
we have a housing crisis right across New Zealand. Certainly it hasn't quite as bad as aspects of the Auckland situation, but here in the Manawatu, I've been working with a number of tenants recently who have been facing rent increases in instances of $80, $120, $140, even $200 a week. They can't afford that. We have abysmal, mouldy, rotting homes here in the Manawatu as well, and we have tenants who are struggling to afford to live in those. And it's those same challenges we're facing that tenants are facing in Auckland.
So, very briefly, do we need heat pumps in homes?
We need all homes to be warm and dry. If heat pumps is the best way to do that, go for it. There is also the allowance in the Healthy Home Standards that it just needs to be a fixed form of heating that can heat the living area to at least 18 degrees Celsius. Maybe a heat pump and maybe a fireplace, but a tenant deserves to have a warm, dry home no matter what.
So that was the Manawatu Tenants Union on heat pumps. And I also did speak to Renters United, and you can check that out on our podcast, which you can find at what's the website?
BFM.com.
BFM.com. That's where you can find them.
BFM.com. Yep.
Renters United also told me that they have organised a campaign. It is fairrentnow.nz, and it is an open letter to current and future MPs to stop the crisis of runaway rents, they told me. So if that's something that you're interested in signing, you can pop there
and
do
it. Head
on
over. There you go.
95 BFM News Election Coverage 2020, Housing. That was The Wire.
That was the Tuesday Wire for another week. Thank you very much to everyone who listened in today and text us. We love hearing from you. Thank you very much to everyone who also spoke with us for the show today. Thank you very much, Hannah, for coping so well despite technical difficulties that often happen here. You know, it is what it is. It's a live radio show. Sometimes it doesn't go perfect, but every time if there's ever an error or something that you've missed or we've had to cut something short, it'll always be podcasted. So head on over to 95bfm.com or to our social media pages, Facebook or Instagram, or even Twitter. We will be posting links to podcasts and various election coverage tidbits there. So yeah, check us out. But anyway, that's us for another week. You have another few days of lovely wires ahead of you to listen in and get your election coverage things. Your election coverage fix, sorry, but yeah. enjoy the sunshine out there if you're in Tamaki Makaurau. It looks pretty beautiful. Yeah, but we will see you next time.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.